Welcome to the Tikva podcast on great Jewish essays and ideas. I'm your host, Eric Cohen. Our subject today is Joseph B. Soloveitchik's classic 1964 essay, Confrontation, one of those rare enduring masterpieces that is both a profound theological reflection on human nature and an important work of Jewish communal policy. This essay and the many commentaries, conversations, and commitments that have fallen in its wake has long shaped how many traditional Jews engage in the public life of modern society and how Orthodox Jews see their relationship to modern Christians and other faith communities. To discuss this important essay, it's my great pleasure to welcome my good friend, Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, senior rabbi of the Spanish-Portuguese Synagogue in New York, and the founder and director of the Strauss Center on Torah and Western Thought. I'll assume the name Soloveitchik is just a coincidence, right?
Yeah,
Jewish name.
No relation.
Right.
Spell the name differently.
Isn't your youngest son actually named after the author of this essay?
He is. Rav Soloveitchik spelled his last name with a T, and we do not. And we like to say that we finally restored the Joseph Soloveitchik name without the T.
No pressure on this kid,
yeah.
Though.
When he was a baby, we called him the lonely baby of faith.
That's very good. Mired in existential angst.
Exactly.
Okay, before we get into the essay itself, can you say a brief word about who Joseph Soloveitchik was? Why was he such an important figure? And where does this essay, Confrontation, fit within his larger project of trying to define Orthodox Judaism in America?
Sure. So Rav Soloveitchik, who I'm going to call either Rav Soloveitchik or the Rav throughout the course of this conversation, was the grandson of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, otherwise known as Reb Chaim Brisker, the Rav of Brisk, and known as the founder of the Brisker method of Talmud study, which changed the way Talmud is studied in yeshivas, first in Europe and now all over the world. To this day, that method is used. He was known as both Reb Chaim as both an incredibly dedicated pastor, but also a genius of the first water. And Rav Soloveitchik grew up imbibing this method of Talmud study from his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. And by the time he reached his early 20s, was already considered himself a Torah giant. It was at this point that Rav Soloveitchik decided to engage the modern world in a profound way as well, and journeyed to the University of Berlin, where he studied philosophy and actually did a PhD in philosophy. Rav Soloveitchik, following this, emigrated to America, became a rabbi in Boston, and with the passing of his father, succeeded Rav Moshe Soloveitchik as essentially the Rosh Yeshiva. I don't know if that was his technical term at the time, but essentially the head of the yeshiva at Yeshiva University, known as Reitz, or Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. In that capacity, Rav Soloveitchik really became the leader of Yeshiva University Orthodoxy, or to use a term that he never used, modern Orthodoxy in America, and not only ordained hundreds and hundreds of rabbis, and not only taught Talmud for many, many decades in Yeshiva University, but also was known for as the father of a worldview that both embraced the traditional Orthodox notion of what it meant to be a religious Jew while simultaneously urging our religious Jews to engage the modern world, to benefit from the modern world, but also to impact the modern world. And he reflected on what it means to be a man of faith in the world and in modern society in a number of different essays, including the one that we're going to be discussing.
And so just before we get deeply into the essay itself, where does this essay fit? I mean, why was Confrontation seen and remains seen as a very important part of his work?
Yeah, so Confrontation is fascinating because it's simultaneously profoundly similar to other essays that he has, but at the same time, it's also very, very different. Rav Soloveitchik has many written meditations on the way the origins of man is described in the beginning of Genesis. The most famous is certainly The Lonely Man of Faith, but he has others, such as Majesty and Humility. And in that respect, a confrontation is of a similar genre. It plays off the biblical description of the creation of man And he utilizes those descriptions as a springboard for reflection on what it means to be a person of faith and what it means to be a person of faith in the modern world, meaning he utilizes the text to develop a religious anthropology. But it's also a profoundly different essay when contrasted with the essays that I just mentioned, because this essay is not just a piece of philosophy or theology. It is several other things as well. First and foremost, it is psak. What I mean by that is that Rav Soloveitchik here, this paper was first delivered at the 1964 February Convention of the Rabbinical Council of America. That's essentially the modern Orthodox rabbinical group in America. And Rav Soloveitchik, as the posek par excellence, the halachic decisor for this organization, is issuing instructions in this essay as to how modern Orthodoxy would act and respond to overtures from the Vatican seeking interfaith dialogue. And so it's both a meditation on the nature of faith, but it's also halakha. It is also both psak and policy. Furthermore, this essay has certain aspects within it that you won't find in many of his essays, and that is there are political aspects to it. This essay is not seen, first and foremost, as a political essay, but I think read with full sensitivity to the many facets that can be found here, it is a reflection on how faiths can coexist in a democratic society, as well as it can also be read as a critique of what the westernized Jew has lost about traditional faith and what it means to be a Jew in the world.
So let's get into the essay more carefully itself. As you suggested, the first part is really a meditation on man's confrontation with the natural world, right?
Yeah.
With a cosmos that defies and challenges man. Or as Soloveitchik writes, once he awakens from the Garden of Eden, from the life of untroubled pleasure, man becomes aware of his singularly human existence, which expresses itself in the dichotomous experience of being unfree, restricted, imperfect, and unredeemed, and at the same time being potentially powerful, great, and exalted, uniquely endowed, capable of rising far above his environment in response to the divine moral challenge. So what is this idea of man's double nature? What is this all about? Why is this so central to his argument? And how does it end up linking to his arguments about the Jew's place in modern society?
Yeah, so this is a duality or a dialectic that you see all over the place in Rav Soloveitchik's writings, and that is that human beings are simultaneously majestic and humble. In other essays, it plays off of, less so here, but it plays off of two different commands that we find given to man in Genesis. So, for example, at the creation of man, in the first chapter of Genesis, man is commanded by God, milu et ha'aretz v'chivshua, fill the world and conquer it and subdue it, which basically means that man has been given immense power to subdue the world and to develop the world. And for Soloveitchik, this means that the achievements by man, and especially the achievements by modern man, are not something that is that is against the spirit of human nature, but rather is part and parcel of the divine mandate. The example of Soloveitchik gives in The Lonely Man of Faith of the majesty of man in the modern world, and you have to see it through his perspective in which this was. If you've grown up in the 1910s, 1920s, and 30s, and now he's writing this a couple decades later, you could sense how miraculous this must seem that we take it for granted. The example he gives is something like a man can board a plane in New York in the morning and be strolling the streets of London by the afternoon. And this was something that was unthinkable several decades earlier. This is the majesty of man, and this is an aspect of man that in modernity, Soloveitchik is saying, we're very cognizant of. At the same time, there's an entirely other aspect of man. In The Lonely Man of Faith, this is seen in the other account of man's creation, where man is not told to fill up the entire earth and subdue it, but rather is placed in the Garden of Eden, l'ovda l'shamra, to work in and to protect it. So man is described here as staying within the Garden of Eden, cultivating not the entire world, but as it were, Adam and Eve's relationship with God. And that is a side of man in which human beings are cognizant of the fact that they are as nothing, as majestic as they may be, they are as nothing when it comes to the omnipotent, omniscient, almighty, all-knowing God. And faith involves, for Rav Soloveitchik, not a denial of these two different aspects, but an attempt to reconcile the two. And it's first and foremost through the command, and he emphasizes that here in Confrontation as well, it's through the Torah, whose commands relate not just to obviously religious things like prayer or the study of the Torah or worship, but relate to every aspect of every dimension of human life, that the two are brought together, that man can be simultaneously majestic and humble, simultaneously acting fully within his or her human capacity as created by God, while at the same time acting as a servant of God. It's a bit of a debate within Rav Soloveitchik studies as to how well the two can be ultimately reconciled. That brings too much into the weeds here. But these are both, the point is that these are both sides of man. They're both willed by God. Neither is to be denied. And it is the Torah that can truly, that can truly bring these two together.
So how is the Jewish situation different? Meaning these terms of human nature and capturing the majestic and humble side of man are accounts of the human, accounts of the human situation, the human condition. But part of what seems very unique about this essay is the way it describes the uniqueness and particularity of the Jewish condition, of the Jew's place in modern society and in the Jew's encounter in all societies of non-Jews. So can you get us to the uniqueness of the Jewish covenant, the Jewish community as a faith community?
Yes, well, first and foremost, we should emphasize, and this is at the heart of Confrontation, and we can return to this, but first and foremost, Rav Soloveitchik would say that the Jewish faith claims are true in a way that other faith claims are not as true. That doesn't mean that there aren't truths that we share, but Judaism makes certain claims about chosenness, the Mosaic authorship of the Torah, the truth of the Torah, the obligation of mitzvot, and the ultimate redemption of the world that are true in a way that other parallel claims that other religions make are not as true.
He's very critical in this essay of Jews who don't grasp that truth about the truths
That's
of
right.
Judaism.
And this is in part rightly understood as an essay on the nature of religious truth. And that is that any religion that ceases to believe that it has the fullest expression of God's truth on this earth ceases to be a religion. He basically says that. It spells doom, I think, for any great religious community. Those are the words he uses, something like that. So we have to begin with that. But aside from that, the uniqueness of the Jews is that the Jews have sought throughout history to actualize both sides of themselves. But the world has not let them. The Jews have always sought, he says, to utilize Abraham's description of himself, to be ger v'toshav imachem, to be a stranger and a neighbor among you, meaning to both say that on the one hand I have this, I am a stranger because I'm set apart by my unique relationship with God, and yet I also want to be in the world. I want to be majestic in the world. I want to be contributing to the world. I want to do both. But whether both in Christendom or in Islam, the Jews were never allowed to do both. And Soloveitchik thinks that in much of modernity, even in places where they might be able to be both, the westernized Jew doesn't want to be both. So Rav Soloveitchik is saying the uniqueness of the Jew is that they've always sought to be both but have never been allowed to do it. And then the tragedy is, and this he doesn't say explicitly, but he basically says it, the tragedy is that in America, where Jews can actually be both, they don't want to be. The joke I always say here about this is, quote the two lines from Yogi Berra, right, where Yogi Berra says, famously, when you come to a fork in the road, you take it. And the other line by Barra is that when he was told that the mayor of Dublin, Ireland, was Jewish, he said, the mayor of Dublin is Jewish only in America. Okay, so Rav Soloveitchik is basically saying, and he's saying this implicitly in confrontation, he's saying, in America we actually have the ability to be both stranger and neighbor. And we can be full participants in society and be proudly Jewish, and not just culturally Jewish. We can be proud about the truth claims that we have made throughout the centuries, truth claims for which our ancestors have been willing to die. So and we can be both in America, and tragically, many Jews don't want to be.
And why is that? Why have so many Jews, in your view, in America, in this moment where they could live both sides of this covenant, to be fully engaged human beings addressing the great problems of human life as part of society on the one hand, and yet on the other hand, living in truth, the calling of being Jews,
right,
the covenant of being Jews. Why do you think there is this tragic mismatch in American Judaism?
So maybe it would be worthwhile to actually look at the quote that Rav Soloveitchik gives here for this and then reflect briefly on that. In the standard PDF that you find online about this, are we posting a PDF? I think we'll post
if the rulers of the Soloveitchik Empire will
allow
it.
Well, I can't speak to that, but it's most famous because it was published after it was delivered at the Rabbinical Council of America Convention. It was published in Tradition. So in the Tradition version, it's page 17. It's the standard PDF version of it today. And Rav Soloveitchik puts it as follows. He says, this is the bottom paragraph, the third line. He says, the emancipated modern Jew, however, has been trying for a long time to do away with this twofold responsibility which weighs heavily upon him. The westernized Jew maintains that it is impossible to engage in both confrontations, the universal and the covenantal, which, in his opinion, are mutually exclusive. It is, he argues, meaning the modern Jew argues, absurd to stand shoulder to shoulder with mankind preoccupied with a cognitive, technological gesture for the welfare of all, implementing the mandate granted to us by the Creator, and to make an about-face the next instant in order to confront our comrades as a distinct and separate community. Hence, the Western Jew concludes, we have to choose between these two encounters. This is the critique. There's no question that this psychology exists among many American Jews. What is behind it? There's a variety of different possibilities. One is and this you'll see the attitude among some American Jews, certainly if you study the history of American Jews in the 20th century, the notion is that there's something un-American about setting yourself apart in this way, to be both stranger and neighbor. That one of the best examples I can give for that is, I actually recently spoke at a conference about Justice Brandeis and his embrace of Zionism. But if you look at a speech, and scholars note this, that if you look at a speech that he gave 10 years before his embrace of Zionism, this was given in 1905, and it was marking the anniversary of the arrivals of Jews in America, something like the 250th anniversary of that, and he gives a speech against what he calls hyphenated identities. That it's un-American and he was speaking about all the Jews who were then arriving from Eastern Europe, and a lot of the Jews in America were worried about how the country would see them because of these Eastern European immigrants who were now showing up by the tens of thousands off the boat. Louis Brandeis, who was not then a Supreme Court justice, says at that point, we have no room for hyphenated identities. Now, he changes, but that's the attitude that Rav Soloveitchik is describing. To capture it with a modern story, this is a line from Shlomo Karbach, who said, I heard this, I think Rabbi Sachs mentioned this somewhere, but the line is Shlomo Karbach said that when I go to an American college campus, if somebody comes over to me and says I'm a Catholic, I know that's a Catholic. If somebody comes over to me and says I'm a Protestant, I know that's a Protestant. When somebody comes over to me and says I'm just a human being, then I know that's a Jew. And the point is, and the tragedy is, that precisely in America, where we can be both, many American Jews do not want to be both. And Rav Soloveitchik is giving actually an argument, as I understand it, in a confrontation, that not only should we seek to be both, but that is what a truly just democratic society would allow every member of every faith to be. And I would add that actually lies at the heart, that vision of a society in which we can be both stranger and neighbor, that actually lies at the very heart of the American vision from its founding.
And specifically, the place of religious freedom in America.
Yeah.
Right? Meaning Soloveitchik in this essay makes a very passionate argument for religious freedom. So I wonder if you could explain a little bit, why is this idea so important to him, religious freedom, and to his larger theological argument about the Jews? And what do you think he would say about the state of religious freedom today, a much debated, much talked about, much worried about issue in American democracy?
So those are two very different questions. One he's addressing directly, obviously, and one obviously he hasn't spoken out about. He's not alive, so he hasn't spoken about the issues.
You're allowed to speculate,
right? So I'm going to speculate.
Even if you don't have a T in your name,
right? Exactly. Well, let me put it this way: there's way too much of people going around saying what the Rav would have said today if he were alive. But with the set, and I've certainly taken certain controversial stances related to religious freedom.
Let's start with the first,
and then with the second question, I'll address it by saying, here's what Rav Soloveitchik would say, but at least here's how Rav Soloveitchik has impacted my own view, if that's okay.
It's a free country.
Yeah, for now. First, Rav Soloveitchik is coming at this within the setting of Vatican II. The final statements of Vatican II about non-Christian religions and about the Jews specifically, most famously Nostra Aetate, have yet to be issued. But interfaith dialogue on a public organizational level is being sought, and many on the Jewish side in America. Both Jewish organizations as well as the most prominent Jewish theologian for non-Jews in America at the time, Abraham Joshua Heschel, are very much stressing the importance of public communal interfaith dialogue. And Rav Soloveitchik is developing an essay within the context of that. And he basically... his ultimate conclusion, and we can discuss what this means, is on a public, a communal level, he's banning for the Rabbinical Council of America the conversations, interfaith dialogue on matters that are inherently and first and foremost theological, but meaning the aspects that relate to our identity as strangers, but is allowing and indeed encouraging public dialogue on matters that relate to our identity as neighbors, aspects relating to the world. Now, this doesn't mean that the aspects related to the world have nothing to do with religion,
including the moral,
capacity, and that's including the moral capacity, and that's very much missed often about what Rav Soloveitchik allows, indeed encourages, and we could talk about that.
Meaning that Jews and Christians can be moral allies,
moral partners, and there the religion is not something that's irrelevant, actually. There are religious conceptions that they share and bind them very much together. And he makes that clear, not as much in the essay itself, but in a series of guidelines that he wrote following the essay, which were originally published in tradition, hand in hand with the essay, but is often not read hand in hand with the essay. So Rav Soloveitchik is writing it in that context. And he's worried about several things. The first he's worried about is a modern or postmodern conception of religion in which the nature of the exclusivity of religious truth is being done away with. And he's emphasizing that this is not true at all. As he puts it, he says that all too often those who are seeking to break down divisions among faiths fail to recognize that the axiological awareness of each faith community is an exclusive one. Because, in his words, each believes, quote, that its system of dogmas, doctrines, and values is best fitted for the attainment of the ultimate good. So, on the one hand, each faith, and this is a profoundly Orthodox conception of faith, one that many traditional Roman Catholics, evangelicals, Mormons, and others would agree with, that there are real disagreements among people of faith. And moreover, and here he's adding a more, as it were, existential or modern, if you will, concept, and that is that even as faiths insist that their faith is the fullest expression of God's truth, on this earth, he's also emphasizing that faith is an existential affair that's often difficult to describe outside of the context of where it takes place. I could tell a Catholic who has not experienced religious Judaism what it's like to be an Orthodox Jew, but you cannot really express it outside the context in which it occurs. Or as he puts it, the word of faith reflects the intimate, the private, the paradoxically inexpressible cravings of the individual for and his linking up with his maker. It reflects the numinous character and the strangeness of the act of faith of a particular community, which is totally incomprehensible to the man of a different faith community. So when you put these two things together, the personal nature of faith and the exclusive truth claims that each faith community makes, or Soloveitchik is saying, when two communities meet, or if one community is pressured to meet on a public level in an interfaith ecumenical setting, where they're specifically going to be seeking, by the very nature of the endeavor, they're going to be seeking commonalities, what will happen is that the profound disagreements among faiths are going to be elided. And so that's the first concern that he has, that so to put it within the religious freedom context, religious freedom means, first and foremost, religious freedom in America should not be we need to be free because you know, all religions are basically the same, so who cares? Which is sometimes how you hear people speak about it. It's actually the exact opposite. Because religious freedom is precious because we have often profound disagreements, and we need to be free to disagree and to voice.
So religious freedom creates the political space for orthodoxy.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And that's a very American idea because the founders in America, or Soloveitchik is not talking about this in the essay, but when you think about it, the founders in America were looking at Europe where people had been killing each other over religious disagreements. And their solution was not to come up with a postmodern theology in which all these religious differences don't matter. Their question was how to create a space in which people can be both strangers and neighbors. How can they they can disagree, but yet have certain political and social conceptions that unite them. So that's the first part of religion.
But as a, just on this, yeah. As a thinker, yeah. He's very different, though, wouldn't you say, the American founders? Meaning the American founders had an understanding of a plurality of orthodoxies and were trying to solve that political problem
right.
through the idea of religious freedom and the institutions of religious freedom. Whereas he is a voice of orthodoxy who cherishes the political project that the founders themselves created, but they had a certain distance from orthodoxy.
It is true that in terms of their actual religious beliefs, they were certainly nothing. Well, it depends who we're talking about, obviously, but many of them at least had a much less, I guess to speak anachronistically, orthodox approach to personal God, etc. But not all of them, but at the same time, they understood that the country was filled with people who really profoundly disagreed. Now, so much so, right, issues of disagreement that to us don't seem like huge issues actually seem like insurmountable issues there. There's you know, the letter I quote a lot is at the meeting of the First Continental Congress in 1774, somebody suggested that they begin with a prayer, and John Jay says something like, you know, we can't all pray together because we're so religiously divided among Anabaptists and Quakers and Anglicans. You know, he's describing different Protestant denominations. And then Sam Adams says, no, we can because we're not bigots, and anyone who's a patriot and a servant to his country, we can pray together. But the fact that John Jay said that shows, I mean, we look at these things nowadays, right, and we think these are major religious differences. You know, the story I always tell within this context when I talk about that is, when I studied a little bit at Yale Divinity School, and during student orientation, you know, we're sitting in circles on the lawn, and somebody there says something like, you know, I'm sitting there wearing my yarmulke, and I feel a little like I stand out. And one of the students says, you know, I really feel like I stick out here being a Presbyterian among so many Episcopalians. And I'm thinking something like, yeah, I hate when that happens, right? When you're, you know, a Presbyterian, everyone's Episcopal. But they're cognizant that in Europe, people are killing each other, or they were killing each other.
So the founders may not obviously had a very different religious experience than Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, right? They're not growing up Orthodox Jews. They're not studying Talmud. They're not doing a lot of these things. But they had a profound understanding of that America was filled with people who had religious differences. Some, like Jefferson, may have thought, yeah, we'll give it some time and all these differences will go away and everyone will become Unitarians or something like that. But others were much more realistic and understood what America and what a flourishing of faith in America would have
been. But let me ask it differently. Do you think this political idea of religious freedom can be derived out of the sources of the Jewish tradition? Or is it a great American idea or a great modern political idea that fits very well with the realization of this Jewish vision of being both stranger and neighbor?
Right.
Those are two different possibilities.
100%. So what you're saying is you could just say that, look, the American conception of religious freedom is not linked to Judaism. You could suggest that maybe. And just Jews happen to luck out by ending up in a society where they could be both stranger and neighbor. But actually, I've argued that confrontation is interesting because Rav Soloveitchik is actually making an argument for religious freedom, combining the two aspects of faith that I mentioned, that on the one hand, they're really disagreeing about the truth, and at the same time, there is a existential or numinous aspect to faith. And what I point to is, and in that respect, the confrontation should be read, at least its reflection on religion and religious freedom, I've argued, is simultaneously profoundly Orthodox, but also, in many ways, profoundly modern, right? On the one hand, it's Orthodox because it's stressing the real truth differences between faiths. On the other hand, there is a profoundly modern aspect to this, in its understanding of the process of faith. What do I mean by that? So if you ask Maimonides, now Soloveitchik himself may have argued differently about Maimonides, but if you look at Maimonides and his opening to his code of law, the Mishneh Torah, he really does seem to understand the first commandment, I am the Lord thy God, etc., as commanding human beings to cognitively know the existence of God through the Aristotelian proof of the unmoved mover. So it's a very cognitive approach to religious belief. It's not, the Rambam is not Kierkegaardian in his approach. Maimonides is not a Kierkegaardian. But Rav Soloveitchik was very, very different. And in The Lonely Men of Faith, Rav Soloveitchik sides with Kierkegaard and ridicules the medieval philosopher's obsession with logic in approaching the divine. And he quotes Kierkegaard's critique of Anselm, who spent many hours in prayer seeking a proof for God's existence. And Kierkegaard's critique was, quote, does the loving bride in the embrace of her beloved ask for proof that he is alive and real? Must the prayer for soul clinging in passionate love and ecstasy to her beloved demonstrate that he exists? And so Rav Soloveitchik is arguing as well that the Jewish belief is not purely cognizant, is not purely cognitive, I'm sorry, in nature. And that's what he means when he says in confrontation that faith reflects the numinous character and the strangeness of the strangeness of the act of faith. So he's actually giving a theological argument for religious freedom, which is that he builds this amazingly on Adam's encounter with Eve in Genesis. In Confrontation, Rav Soloveitchik notes that Adam encounters Eve, and he describes his wife as an Ezer Kenegdo, literally a helpmate against him. And he says that human beings are by definition different. So, and he builds that for, and this is an amazing point to stress, that for all the fact that people often focus on the fact that confrontation is banning certain engagements between the Jewish community and the Catholic Church, he's using man and wife to compare Jews and Christians in this essay. But he's by using the term helpmate against him, he's saying human beings are different and they're gonna disagree about religion. It's gonna happen. And that's why we need religious freedom. But the fact that human beings disagree about religion does not mean that they're all equally true either. So one is more true than the rest.
So is religious freedom today strong or in peril as you see it?
Right.
And given all that has changed in the moral and cultural and political world since 1964,
right,
do you think he would seek out more Jewish-Christian partnership on the great moral challenges of the day? Or less.
All right, so let's start with the religious freedom question. So why I think religious freedom is very much in peril, and by religious freedom I mean the unique vision of religious freedom that he's putting out here. What do we mean by religious freedom? And what is the American vision of religious freedom? If you ask me, is religious freedom in peril in the sense that I'm worried that someone's going to storm into a synagogue and arrest a Jew, or storm into a church and arrest a priest for practicing their faith? No, of course not. I'm not worried about that. But we have to start with the following, that the American version of religious freedom is unique because from its very founding, it tried to create a society where people could be both stranger and neighbor, meaning that they can be part of society while openly keeping their religious identity. If you ask yourself, what was unique about the Constitution's approach to religious freedom? If you walked into a law school, what's the most important aspect about religious freedom in the Constitution? My guess is almost every student will say First Amendment. And this would reflect a profound misunderstanding of what the First Amendment originally meant. First Amendment originally just was meant to stop the federal government from interfering with the states, who could have whatever religious establishments they want. When you read the writings of the earliest American Jews about America and why it was different, the Jews that were part of my synagogue, actually, of Sheir of Israel, the most striking aspect of the Constitution, which was unparalleled anywhere else in the Western world for a long time, was that it banned any religious test for public office, which meant that you could actually be an open Jew and be in Congress, or be a federal appointee, or be an ambassador, or be a member of the cabinet, while openly maintaining your Judaism. That was unheard of. In terms of their ability to live prosperous lives and practice the religion of freedom, Jews had that in England, Jews had that in Amsterdam, they had that in various places in the 1770s. But this was the first time where you could actually combine these two aspects that Rav Soloveitchik is talking about, that you can bear your religion with you out into the world.
So what are you worried about?
So if you take a look at what the recent debates about religious freedom have been, they're about precisely that. They're about contentions made by an administration that the moment you leave your church and engage the world, you cease to be acting in a religious capacity. So let's take an example, a Supreme Court case that's actually in the Supreme Court right now. Little Sisters of the Poor versus Burwell, I think is what it is. Now, that's the technical title. What it is essentially is, and ridiculously, the United States versus the Little Sisters of the Poor. Now, this is the new great threat in society for the current administration is a group of nuns who basically exist to serve the poor. Now, there's a whole background to this, but to engage in an extreme simplification, there's a healthcare mandate which obligates groups to provide their employees with insurance that will also cover certain things that Little Sisters of the Poor are religiously opposed to, birth control, abortifacient drugs, etc. Anyone who fails to comply with this mandate is fined. The administration then came up with a quote-unquote compromise in which they sign a form which would put those obligations on an insurance company rather than on them. They argue that this is still an act of facilitation that is against their religion, and that's what's in court right now. But the real scandal is often not commented about, which is that the administration, and this is what I testified about in Congress, is that the administration has an exemption for religious organizations from the health care mandate, but it doesn't consider Little Sisters of the Poor a religious organization because they're not praying in a monastery. They're seeking to help in the public square people who are poor of a variety of different faiths. And so they're not acting in a religious capacity for the administration, and therefore they're not entitled to a religious exemption. Whereas what the point of Soloveitchik is making is that religion is not only about putting on phylacteries or studying Talmud in the Beit Midrash or praying in a synagogue. Religion is part of, is with you and obligates you in every aspect of your engagement of the world. Rav Soloveitchik's description of this in The Lonely Man of Faith, and this is a parallel to his notion of stranger and neighbor, is what does it mean to be a Jew? Why do we seek to be both stranger and neighbor? And he says that on the one hand, the Bible commands man, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and all thy soul and all thy might. On the other hand, these are his words, the same Bible which just enjoined man to withdraw from the periphery to the center commands him to return to the majestic community which builds, plants, harvests, regulates rivers, heals the sick, participates in state affairs, is imaginative in dreaming, bold in planning, daring in undertaking, and is out to conquer the world. With what simplicity, not paying the least attention to the staggering dialectic implied in such an approach, the Bible speaks of an existence this worldly centered, meaning engaged in the world, but Rav Soloveitchik adds, is theo-oriented and unqualifiedly committed to an eternal purpose. And here I'm quoting selectively, says, the task of covenantal man is to be engaged in uniting the two, where man is both the creative free agent and the obedient servant of God. And America was really the first place that you can enter society and still be loyal to your faith. And that's what we're seeing, and that was a uniquely American conception of religious freedom. And that's what's being threatened.
So I want to read one last passage from the confrontation essay, which struck me as an incredible example of Jewish boldness, Jewish theological self-confidence. And I want to ask you one last theological question. In the confrontation essay, he writes, we cannot command the respect of our confronters, by which he means other faith communities, by displaying a servile attitude. Only a candid, frank, and unequivocal policy reflecting unconditional commitment to our God, a sense of dignity, pride, and inner joy in being what we are, believing with great passion in the ultimate truthfulness of our views, praying fervently for and expecting confidently the fulfillment of our eschatological vision, when our faith will rise from particularity to universality, will impress the peers of the other faith community, among whom we have both adversaries and friends.
Yeah.
So my last question to you is, if Orthodox Jews believe they know and live the real truth about God and man, you've talked a lot about religious truth, what do Orthodox Jews believe about non-Jews? Do they believe that their theology is a falsehood? What do we want, what do you want, non-Jews to really believe? And can they believe in truth, can they live in truth without converting to Judaism? Can their moral lives be grounded in a theological falsehood? It seems to me that this essay is such a profound reflection on both the Jewish covenant and the Jewish way of being in the world and the Jewish encounter with other faith communities, and I think a respectful account of that. But it's not sure what it really says. It's unclear to me what it really is saying about what Jews believe non-Jews should believe.
Right.
If Judaism is true, shouldn't we want them to believe and live in the truth? And yet, that doesn't seem to be what he's saying.
Yeah. So that's a very important question. First and foremost, Rav Soloveitchik would say that we obviously do believe that we have the fullest expression of God's truth on this earth. But his meditation on the origins of religious differences comes with an awareness as well that, by definition, people are going to believe different things. And not only that, this is not a faith is not something that you could just write an argument on the board, you know, and QED, and then you've convinced them to it. He did not have a medieval approach to a medieval philosophical approach to the faith experience. His notion of religious truth is profoundly orthodox, but his understanding of the faith experience is existential. So he's saying, even if you think you, it's just not, even if you wanted to convince other people in that way, it's that's not how faith works. And that itself comes with a profound misunderstanding of the religious process. That's the first point. Second point I would make is that confrontation, rightly read and strikingly read, is that he's giving advice in a certain way, not just to Jews, but to Christians in this moment of ecumenical fervor. He's saying, and he says this, that a waiving of eschatological claims spells the end of any religious community. He's basically saying, if you give up on your exclusive religious truth claims, you're not gonna keep going. You're not gonna endure. And it's a very prescient notion, because if we see which religions have thrived in America.
He's telling Orthodox Christians to stay Orthodox.
Well, he doesn't say it exactly that way. He's not saying, no, you guys should believe in Jesus even stronger than you are. He's certainly not saying it that way. But he's saying, look, this is how religions thrive and this is how religions don't thrive. And it's an amazingly prescient thing, because in the 1960s, there were probably a lot of people who would say, oh, if we really want Roman Catholicism to thrive, we need, you know, all of the liberalizations that Vatican II can bring us, right? And actually, if you look 50 years into the future, what are the religions that have thrived in America? It's the religions that make strong truth claims. Right, at the time, right, everyone's talking about the Pew Report today, right? And the flourishing and continuity of Orthodox Judaism. That's not how they were seeing things in 1964. In 1964, Orthodoxy was not the future of organized Judaism in America, right? So he's making this case. That's why confrontation is not just a religious reflection, a theological reflection. It's a sociological, it can be read as a sociological prediction, one with incredible prescience. You look at that and you look at what religions are growing in America, and he's saying this is how religions continue. And moreover, it's the very right and the ability to keep this in America where we can proclaim our belief in capital T truth that actually can unite Jews and Christians, Jews and traditional Christians, even as they disagree about the truth. Pope Benedict's theology, rightly understood, if you look at it, and obviously it's a very different focus than his successor, Pope Benedict's emphasis is rightly understood is, look, you got to understand that religion is first and foremost about the truth. And I've said that emphasis can is something that Orthodox Jews would identify with in Benedict's writing, even as we have profound, even as we both agree that we disagree. So that's one side of it. The other side I want to state to this is that that Rav Soloveitchik even is saying that, of course, to be a member of traditional faith is to believe that members of other traditional faiths are profoundly wrong about certain things. There are certain religious truths that we have in common and that bind us together. And here I want to reference...
Religious truths or moral truths?
Both. Absolutely both. And here I want to emphasize the series of guidelines that Rav Soloveitchik wrote that were appended to Confrontation when it was published, when it was issued, but is not read today. You can read it today now. It was published in Rav Soloveitchik's letters, the book called Community Covenant and Commitment, Selected Letters and Communications. but this was published as an open letter in the Rabbinical Council of America record. And Rav Soloveitchik emphasizes different subjects that he wants people to have, that he does not, that he's banning public dialogue on, such as Jewish monotheism and the Christian idea of the Trinity, the Messianic idea in Judaism and Christianity, the Jewish attitude on Jesus, the Eucharist Mass and Jewish prayer service, etc. But then he says the following. He says, when, however, we move from the private world of faith to the public world of humanitarian and cultural endeavors, communication among the various faith communities is desirable and even essential. We are ready to enter into dialogue on such topics as, now here are the topics he mentions, war and peace, poverty, freedom, man's moral values, the threat of secularism, technology and human values, civil rights, etc., which revolve around religious, spiritual aspects of our civilization. And then he adds the following. He says, when we engage these things, we're united by certain religious truths that we share. And he says, Jewish rabbis and Christian clergymen cannot discuss sociocultural and moral problems as sociologists, historians, or cultural ethicists in agnostic or secularist categories. As men of God, our thoughts, feelings, perceptions, and terminology bear the imprint of a religious world outlook. We define ideas in religious categories, and we express our feelings in a peculiar language which quite often is incomprehensible to the secularist, end quote. Which means, for Rav Soloveitchik, first and foremost, he refers to both Christians and Jews as men of God. Which does mean that despite the profound religious disagreements that exist, he believes that Jews and Christians can speak of God and to some extent mean the same thing. And that whatever this same thing is that they mean to some extent, that defines their moral, this religious similarity defines the similarities in their moral outlook. So that when they use moral terms, they come from a religious foundation that they share. And so when it comes to commonalities that Jews and Christians might have, say, on the sanctity and the inviolability of human life, that's because their notion, when they speak about the inviolability of human life, a secular person may use the same phrase, but they mean an entirely different thing. Because, as Rav Soloveitchik says, in discussion we apply the religious yardstick and the religious idiom. He means both Jews and Christians. We evaluate man as the bearer of God's likeness. Meaning, when Jews and Christians speak about the inviolability of man, they mean a religious conception. A moral conception that is grounded in the religious conception of the fact that we are created in the image of God. That's why human life is inviolable. That's why the Bible stresses that human life is inviolable. Or as he puts it, in a word, even our dialogue at a socio-humanitarian level must inevitably be grounded in universal religious characters and values. These are values that we share. And so our Soloveitchik is not only banning certain forms of public interfaith dialogue, he's also encouraging, even urging, religious dialogue about the biblical morality that we share and the threat that secularism might actually pose to those values that we share. So Rav Soloveitchik is saying, rather than focus on our religious differences, we should be focusing on our moral similarities, which are grounded in our shared religious similarities.
Well, it's a great, subtle, and important essay. I encourage everybody to read it, and I really want to thank Rabbi Soloveitchik for helping us understand it and helping us understand its continuing significance for the great issues that we face as moderns, as Jews, and as Americans. Rabbi, thank you.
Thank you for having me.